Look, if you're still buying weed from some guy named Trevor in a parking lot, you're doing it wrong. Mood.com delivers legal THC products straight to your door. Gummies, vapes, flower, the good stuff. No sketchy DMs, no med card. Just add to cart, check out, and boom, it's at your doorstep. It's legal in all 50 states thanks to the Farm Bill, and Mood's products actually work. Seriously, this isn't gas station garbage. It's small batch, lab tested, real results. Go to mood.com, use code FIRST20 for 20% off, and never run dry again. That's mood.com. Go get lit, legally.
Hey everybody, David here. You may recall a while back when Andor season 2 was running, I got a chance to have a long conversation with Tansy Gardam, who writes and produces the podcast Going Rogue. And she does these incredible deep dives into film production, and in some cases does these multi-part series, other times just these standalone episodes. And I find the insights that she has really fascinating, and I really nerd out on all of the behind-the-scenes stuff that she talks about, especially with shot compositions and production and things like that, stuff that I really like. Anyway, she had just released a new standalone episode on the film Dread from 2012. And that was a project of Alex Garland's, who is in the media a lot recently, with 28 Years Later, as well as another movie called Warfare. So I was really fascinated by this episode and thought I wanted to ask her some questions. So she graciously agreed, and we recorded this interview, and we talk about the movie Dread, starring Carl Urban, also a twinned film called The Raid, which came out just about the same time. We talk a little bit about Alex Garland, and then we get into some behind-the-scenes stuff on how Tansy produces her, writes and produces her podcasts. So I hope you enjoy this episode. As always, a reminder, there are links in the show notes to everything. Tansy's Blue Sky and Patreon are in there. I would strongly encourage you to go check out her Patreon. It's an incredible value for the quality of work that she puts into it. So, you know, if you want to support creators like her or like us, Patreon is really the best way. We appreciate your support. We are currently covering Foundation. John and Marilyn are covering that. Jean and Alicia have been doing a lot of work in the movie and comic space. Obviously, we had Ironheart and Superman just dropped, and we've got Fantastic Four coming up. And I'll be covering Alien Earth when it comes out in August. So check all those out. Subscribe to the feed. Check out our Patreon as well if you want to support what we do. And as always, thanks for listening. Tansy Gardam, welcome back to the Lorehounds. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, pleasure. Your last podcast really caught my attention because it's not a topic that I, like, the title was not like, oh, like, I really want to know about Dread.
Look, it's important to not have, like, topics that really attract listeners. It's important to really not chase an algorithm. It's important to make your content as inaccessible as possible.
There's a fidelity in there to being human, right?
Yeah, that to just chasing something you remember from 2012.
Exactly. You know, and I think that's an kind of an important place to start because, you know, why Dread? And, you know, then why smuggle in The Raid? We'll get there in a minute. But you make some arguments about what Dread represents in the space of filmmaking and to putting things on screen, because we're getting to this weird convergence between television and movies. But that's another topic that I hope we can get into a little bit. But can you sort of outline your central premise or your thesis, so to speak, of this episode and what it is that you were driving at with tackling this topic.
Yeah, absolutely. So Dread, for those who don't know, is a 2012 film. It was broadly independent. It was funded by a lot of different pre-sales. It was a British production. And it has kind of fallen into legend as the directorial debut of Alex Garland, who went on to do Ex Machina, is his formal debut. He did Annihilation. He's just recently done, he co-directed Warfare. He wrote 28 Days Later and the subsequent 28 Years, which has just come out. So I find him fascinating as a filmmaker. I've long been a fan, particularly of his writing. But Dread is really interesting because, A, it's quite a B film. It's very aware of its own limitations as a film. It's very ambitious. It's trying to do a really ambitious world on a relatively small budget. It is not formally Garland's directorial debut. He wrote it and produced it, and it was kind of well known that he had taken over in the edit. And the thesis that I come to with the episode is one that Garland really draws, which is he's kind of refused to talk about Dread from a directorial perspective because his argument is that to do so erases everyone else who was involved in the production. It erases the cinematographer Anthony Dodd Mantle, the composer Paul Leonard Morgan, the editor Mark Eckersley, that all of these people get lost in this essentially pissing contest between himself and the credited director.
Right.
So central premise of the episode kind of unfolds over the course of it in that a lot of the time on Going Rogue, we will start with the story of a film and then get to the point where it is taken over by a different director. This one we came in straight with. If you've heard of this, chances are you know that Alex Garland shadow directed it. But what does it mean to shadow direct? And is that even the discussion that we should be having?
It's interesting because this whole thing that you know, you start to unpack in your episode, and you've got some great audio clips too of Garland himself talking about these things. But this idea that there's a collaboration, while we, a viewing audience, are intellectually aware of that, and we certainly see, if you stick around for all the credits, especially of a CGI movie these days that go on for days, right? But that starts to butt up against auteur theory.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that Garland thinks auteur theory is bullshit. I think that that would be a fair summation of his theories. But within that, he also is interested in showrunner theory, where the writer is given a degree of power that they are usually not on film. Showrunner is really common in television, far less common in film. But yeah, he really highlights like individual team members, like a set decorator who made creative choices that really fed into the film. So you do lose those people's names. Like these are crew members that don't get their own title cards, but their impact on the film is not necessarily as big as the director, but it can really create choices that are then attributed to the director. So Garland really argues against that.
It's interesting too, after our last conversation about Andor, especially you know, around the season two of it all, Gilroy, right? It was all Tony Gilroy. And I caught myself on podcast trying to remember, wait a minute, there's a group of people here that are involved in the production, especially on the Star Wars lore stuff, because Tony Gilroy is the last person that would say he knows anything about Star Wars.
Yeah. So I think Pablo Hidalgo was credited as the law consultant on Andor.
Consultant makes it sounds like he sort of swanned
or maybe in. It was even law master. Like he got a particularly fun credit for that one.
But even so, that's like, oh, he swung in. He, you know, said a couple things, issued an invoice, and then walked away.
No, he's deeply embedded in Lucasfilm. He would have been the law master from the outside. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
if you're just the average, like, oh, everybody's talking about Andor, so let me go check it out. The only thing you know about it is Tony Gilroy.
Yeah. And there's definitely like marketing has an influence on that, on being able to sell from the person who brought you Michael Clayton.
Right. Right.
But it is a minimization of so many people.
I mean, I think we're already kind of here in some ways in our conversation now, which is the convergence of big screens and small screens, so to speak. Or I am increasingly challenged to understand because I can watch a movie on my laptop as opposed to, you know, hopping down to the local cinema. So when you talk about auteur theory versus showrunner theory and this, what's happening, I mean, and going back to Andor again, that these were a series of small movies that were bundled into this episodic format. Mm. What should we start to think about when it comes to when somebody like Alex Garland says, you should not credit me as the sole creative behind this piece of material?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting because this collides with the collapse of television in that we've seen an absolute like breakdown of the numbers of episodes right. in a television series. It's very common to have 6 episodes in a series now, which was always common in Britain, never common in the US. Like that was a mini series previously. It is now, right. you know, a season that you might wait 18 months for. So we've seen a collapse in the size of television. That has also come with an increase in showrunner power in a lot of cases. We are now seeing director showrunners where previously the showrunner was largely the domain of the writer. But within that, we're also seeing the collapse of television episodic director as a job. So Andor is a perfect example of this. They went with a European model where a director will direct a block of episodes, which in Andor's case was 3 episodes. Usually those were a story arc, but there is also the possibility that it'll be something like, I think Benjamin Caron was the director on the first season who did the last 2 episodes and also episode 7, which is an odd outlier of episodes, but it is about bundling that together, the director coming in and doing 3 episodes at a time. And there isn't really as much standalone storytelling in television now. It's very rare that you will watch 1 episode of something. So I can understand that from a viewer perspective. It's so rare that you will sit down and be like, oh, what's on tonight? I'll catch an episode of that. I didn't care for it. I'm never watching it again. You probably don't watch shows out of order anymore. So all of that comes back onto the showrunner as someone who is crafting a story. And now that audiences are consuming things in one go or consistently, they are watching an entire show, that does give the showrunner more power in that they are crafting a narrative that is going to go out entirely to the audience as opposed to trying to kind of meet them where they are. In terms of viewing, a lot of this probably doesn't answer your question. but concurrent to that collapse in television, we've had the rise of the cinematic universe as a concept, which I would say mm-hmm. is actually now collapsing in and of itself.
I wouldn't disagree.
But Kevin Feige of Marvel is yeah. probably the closest thing we have to a film showrunner, where as a producer, he was largely across creative decisions. He was kind of keeping things consistent over the entire franchise. And in that first phase, you also have, unfortunately, Joss Whedon is kind of the directorial creative voice who was showing up on other sets to make sure that everything fit together. But that is still more the role of a television director than a film director.
Right.
So historically, we have seen those two forms as very separate. Now they're all collapsing as, you know, as you say, you can watch a film or TV on your laptop. The medium of consumption has become far more uniform. So the content itself has.
And we're recording on the weekend that Superman.
Yes.
James Gunn's Superman is out.
Yeah,
DC universe.
Which absolutely feels like the second movie in a universe. And I don't know if that's what they went in with as their idea, but
Have you seen it yet?
Yeah, I saw it yesterday. And okay. yeah, even the friend I saw it with is not as cursed to media as I am. And he was saying afterwards that he assumed he had missed a previous film. He was like, oh yeah, I picked it up fairly quickly, but I assumed that, you know, there was something that had happened before. I hadn't seen it. This was continuing on that.
That's interesting because obviously we're avoiding spoilers because it's not a Superman podcast, but that's something that you and I have talked about, especially around the Andor thing, which is the way that exposition is handled.
Mm.
And I think bringing it back to the dread of things.
Yes.
Stallone, I watched the Stallone movie, the Carl Urban movie, and also The Raid. And at various points, each of the 3 films handles their exposition dumps or world building setups a little bit differently. But I thought overall, they all did a reasonably passable job because there's not going to be that many people who are going to know the dread. Well, for the 2 Dread movies, they're not, you know, if you're not a fanboy of the comics, then you do need some world exposition, right?
Yeah, whereas Superman is playing with, obviously, the cultural knowledge of Superman. So it is right. going in, it's not doing an origin story. It opens with some on-screen text sort of setting the table, and then it goes in with, he's been Superman for 3 years. This is the first time he's lost a fight. So that is essentially almost acknowledging that the audience have probably
seen
another Superman movie. It's the first minute. I'd say it's the first 60 seconds of the film.
Okay. Just, make sure that people, because people are weird on the internet, right? Like, this is a weird convergence that's just sort of coming out of the conversation here. Is that with the Dread films and with Garland shadow directing and writing the Carl Urban version, this world of comic book adaptation, I'm just personally curious as to your sense of where are we in this world? And is it still a rich vein to mine? Is it still a good place where auteurs or creative teams or whatever should be digging for cultural
I think there's artifacts? definitely still a lot of really great comic books that could be adapted that have the space for them. The interesting one is something like DC, Marvel, or 2000 AD, which is where Judge Dredd comes from.
Are you a comic person yourself?
I'm culturally a comic book person. I'm largely not practicing. but yeah, there are like
I love that explanation.
But within those particular lines, you've got hundreds of writers, hundreds of artists. You've got all of these different interpretations on the character. So even deciding which particular vein you tap is a creative choice. So it's almost, this is going to sound wanky, it's closer to making a history film where there's kind of different historical interpretations of certain characters and how they would behave and what world they're existing in. And, you know, every 10 or so years they have to do a hard reset of the franchise because it's become too difficult to keep track of who is where at what point.
Right.
So there is definitely still story there. Whether or not there's audience there, I think is interesting. Because definitely audience fatigue has come for comic book movies. There's been a real dearth of good films for a while. We've had Thunderbolts this year, which was treated as a great return to form for Marvel. I would say it is the best MCU film in the past 5 years. It's a 3-star. It's not anything phenomenal. It's not bad. It's, you know, it's got some really great, interesting, creative choices.
Yeah, I did see it. Yeah. It's fine. It met expectations.
Yeah. If it had come out in 2014, I think that, maybe in 2014 it would have been frothed over. But like definitely if Marvel were at a stronger point in their releases, it would have had a different reception.
It's a hard one because oftentimes they've fallen into a pattern, I think, unfortunately, which is the fate of the world is at stake. This, this grouping of people
must
have to get
together
over themselves and their group dynamics to be, and then they do, and then by doing so, they solve the crisis of the fate of the world.
And it's incredible that James Gunn, even while making a Superman movie, has still managed to make a movie about a group of little B-list freaks. Like that is still Superman. He's still made a James Gunn movie.
Well, back again, we keep pulling off
back
the
to Dredd
of it.
Yeah.
There was something I was struck by too. Let's talk a little bit about Dredd itself, especially the with Carl Urban. It took me a while because I watched the Stallone film first, and then I watched the Carl Urban. Then I had a real problem with Carl Urban at first because he did not have this screen presence that Stallone does, and they didn't costume him in a way that actually filled out the uniform.
And I think as well, like it's a very minor thing, but Carl Urban is obviously Kiwi. His American accent is good. There's something a little wrong about it. There's something that is sort of non-specific in a very like tiny
sort of
way.
Sort an uncanny valley thing.
And when you combine that with Olivia Thelby, she's the highest ranked or the highest billed American in the cast, but Lena Headey as Mama, also that little sense of like, you are a Brit, aren't you?
One of the things that I was really fascinated by, though, with the Alex Garland version was the pacing. It had this really steady, slow pacing that seemed to maintain for the whole movie. It never really sped up and it never really slowed down. It just kept its beat. And I thought that was an interesting directorial and editing. But one of the things that I kind of struck me after I finished watching the movie was how the slow-mo drug kind of affect the pacing? Was that something that they were trying to connect?
I think they definitely went with the aim of the film being relentless, like it having a fairly consistent pace throughout. And within that, you also have the idea that this is a day in the life for Judge Dredd. The kind of core premise of the film is that it's not this is his worst day. It's not this is his first day. It's that for him, this is just the job. So there is definitely an argument for that idea of it's, you know, it should feel like sending your emails and doing your printing and getting all of your work done in an office job. It should be just kind of what happens as you go through your day for him.
And the judge character, and I think you point this out in your podcast, his arc, his degree of change is...
It's minuscule
across the comics, right? That's the way I think you said that the comics were laid out. So in this, we have no deviation of his character arc until that very moment when he gives her a pass. Obviously, there's big. I'll do it in the intro here. That this is big spoilers for the movie, but he gives Anderson the pass for
and like I hadn't actually thought about this. There is a funny version of the film where he doesn't. Where at the end, he's just like, nope.
She lost her weapon.
And, you know, that is, you don't want to end a 90-minute action film with a punchline, but.
It's funny. I was just on guest podcasting with Properly Howard, which is one of our affiliates, and Steve and Anthony are doing this Bacon Wrap season where they're going from movie to movie using Kevin Bacon as this interstitial tissue. And they invited me on to record The Fugitive with them, which was a Harrison Ford jumping point. And it's interesting because Harrison Ford, I think, goes into the next one. They came into this from No Country for Old Men, which was, what's his name?
Tommy Lee Jones.
Yes, thank you, Tommy Lee Jones. And there's a similar thing with Tommy Lee Jones's character. All the way through the movie, I don't care, I don't care, I don't care, I don't care. And then at the very end, when they get in the car with, you know, and he undoes his handcuffs, he says, you know, I thought you didn't care. And he says, don't tell anybody. And so that's his little same Judge Dredd sort of 2-degree arc of character development.
Yeah. And definitely like that level of development has a reward for the audience. It does feel like a payoff, I guess. A bizarre kind of corollary to this is Captain Holt from Brooklyn Nine-Nine as a character who is so straight, so set in his ways.
Right.
That when he does occasionally break from that character, it almost feels like a little treat, particularly because Brooklyn Nine-Nine is a comedy. But, you know, the way that he will break is explaining that he was hula hooping and things like that. Like,
Right. Pour one out for Andre Brower.
Fantastic actor.
Homicide: Life on the Street was one of my favorite television shows while it was on air. And I've been sort of, you know, we're so busy with so many other things. And I'm like, God, I just would love to go back and dig back into those. But then I couldn't not podcast about it. So I can't watch them and not be podcasting about it. But, you know, that's the curse of being a podcast host. Let's talk about The Raid and this whole twin film things.
The Raid. If you haven't seen it, go watch The Raid. Like, we'll be waiting. You can pause this. It's 90 minutes. Like,
You know, it's funny. Maybe you built it up for me as I was listening.
Oh,
to the
you
podcast.
Weren't as big a fan.
Okay, so just skip the story and gone straight to the action. I would have been more happy with The Raid. I just didn't need the character backstory stuff. I just needed the action.
But there's so little of it. You weren't missing out.
But even so, it colored my ability. I was like, oh, come on. You know, let's get back to the action.
Well, then The Raid 2 is not for you.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. Can I just take the good bits out? Yeah. I will say the fight choreography is some of the best fight choreography.
It's phenomenal.
And
yeah.
I love a good action movie. And one of the things that I hate about the modern crop of films is I just get lost as to who's punching whom, where are they, what part of the room are they in, and who got knocked out of the window, blah, blah, blah. It's just so fast cut and it's that mixture of fast cut and shaky cam that I just can't handle it.
But the geography of the action in The Raid, because The Raid does cut really fast and it's shot on a fig rig, so it's not handheld, but it is relatively unstable cinematography. But just the way that everything unfolds is so well put together that you're never confused about who is fighting who at any point. Like in The Raid 2, there's a fight in a mud pit, essentially, and it would be so easy to lose track of who these guys are as they're just absolutely slathered in mud. But you can tell you are aware of what's happening as it unfolds, which is just like excellent action filmmaking.
And you talk a bunch about this. You actually start to break down the process that they went through to film The Raid in your episode.
Yeah, they had so basically the two stars, I suppose you would call them, depending on how you define the stars. So Iko Uwais, who is undisputably the star of these movies, and then also Yayan Rashian.
As Rama.
Yes, he was in all of Gareth Evans' Indonesian films. Yeah, he was a Pencaksilat fighter. He did a lot of demonstration fights. So he came from that background, and he also worked with Yayan Ruhian, who was another Pencaksilat demonstration fighter. So those were the two action choreographers across The Raid and also previous movies. But they would essentially choreograph all of the action scenes with Gareth Evans, the director, with a handycam. And they would pre-plan everything down to like the shot size, the shot length. They would have pre-cut the action sequences to make sure that everything flowed. And they used that as a template when they were actually filming to ensure, like, if they were cutting on the day, they put it together, they were dropping it into the existing template and a cut didn't match, then they'd be able to pick it up. So for them, it was partly a security method of, we're relatively new to action filmmaking. We've got quite a low budget. We can't go back to a set once it's been struck. Like, we need to keep moving. We need to know exactly what we're doing.
But right, in making sure, we can't pluck this actor out of the Maldives or the south of France on their film set and fly them back here at the drop of dime.
Yeah, or more a case of, well, we broke down that set and we can't afford to put it back together.
Right.
But yeah, so it was for them a way to ensure that they actually knew what they were doing, and by going in with a handycam beforehand, making sure that everything would actually work. And it works so well that, like, there is an argument, this is kind of how some second units and action units would work, but the way that they stuck so closely to it, and that Evans was actually involved in the planning of the action scenes rather than getting a, you know, demo reel and deciding we'll do those shots, we'll change it up here. It's just a really cohesive filmmaking method, and the result is, you know, the result speaks for itself.
Do we see that, you know, other film productions have picked up that specific methodology?
It's really common for your action units to shoot previews like this. Actually, you know, not to cross promo, but David Leitch and Chad Stahelski, the directors of John Wick, were kind of at the forefront of doing that. They used to do a lot of previews with their company, 8711, and that was sort of what they were known for a while.
I'm going to side plug your Ballerina episode as well. Definitely go check out your coverage of Ballerina.
Yeah, so they kind of started doing that when relatively like early in digital. So they were actually able to shoot digitally, edit digitally, send that off, give an example of what the action scenes that they wanted to do and how they wanted them to look. So it's really common for your action guys to do that. It is less common for the director to be the one in there with the handycam, you know, on the crash mats, working with your lead actors slash choreographers. So right. I honestly don't think that you would get that degree of cohesion unless it was maybe with early Stahelski and Leitch. These days, they're quite established filmmakers. I'm not sure that they'd honestly have the time to get that close and personal to the action choreography. And they really rely on all of the guys they've trained up. Like, they have essentially a university of action filmmaking. Yeah, it's not that you don't see the adoption of this. It's that it was already an existing method, and it just hasn't really been utilized to the same degree. And even Gareth Evans' more recent films don't use it to the same degree, to their detriment.
Yeah. You know, I was weaned on 80s action, you know, cinema. I was a teenager during the 80s. And so what did we do? We went to saw the movie. And then we rented it on videotape when it finally made it around. And this was some of the cleanest, best, most interesting fight choreography that I'd ever seen. Especially when you have the final fight with Rama, his brother, and then the main...
Yeah, so Mad Dog is played by Yayan Ruhian, who is the other fight choreographer. And if you haven't seen The Raid, but you have seen John Wick 3, Yayan Ruhian and Chitip Arif Rahman, who is in The Raid 2, they both appear in John Wick 3. They're the chatty Indonesian guys who are sort of talking to John between the rounds of the fight. And John Wick doesn't kill them. He actually respects them enough to just be like, I'll be seeing you. They taught him how to say that in Indonesian. So,
and so then we have this weird convergence of these two films in parallel production, and then the Raid made it on screen. I went wide first.
Yeah. So The Raid and Dread have essentially the same plot. They're both about a police raid on a tower block and the progressive move up that tower block that is controlled by a drug lord. They are like, there are strange convergences within them in terms of like, oh, this is how you introduce your villain. Oh, you're going to have a fight scene with this. A lot of that is just coincidence or, you know, logical storytelling choices if you are setting a fight in a building. the raid begins production after Dredd has wrapped, but because the action scenes were so tightly pre-planned, the edit was, it's not even that the edit was relatively fast, it's that they kind of got fast-tracked by their distributors. So they were pushed to make a really tight turnaround. Essentially, the film premiered at Toronto about a year after they started work on it. Meanwhile, Dredd spent 18 months in post-production, partly because it was shot in 3D, partly because it had issues in its post-production. But as a result, Dredd, which had been in the works since about 2008, came out about 6 months after The Raid. And the instant comparison was, well, The Raid is so good, this isn't as good as The Raid. Had Dredd come out first, I think it would have been a slightly different story. I think it would have been, oh, The Raid is so good, The Raid is a better version of Dredd, as opposed to Dredd is a worse version of The Raid.
So you think, would you argue that The Raid actually took some wind out of the sails of Dredd?
Yeah.
Or was Dredd just going to always have a mediocre...
I think Dredd was always going to have some issues in that it is not a huge budget, but a relatively high budget adaptation of a British comic that never cracked it in the States. And right. I think that there was kind of writing on
Except
the wall.
Except to the heads.
Yeah.
Right.
There's definitely like writing on the wall in terms of audience there. There is possibly a better release for Dredd, but honestly,
You're always in the shadow of Stallone in that instance,
yes,
too.
Yeah, you are absolutely contending with the adaptation. I suppose it's kind of like trying to do a Dark Tower now, in that there is, mm-hmm. you know, the Dark Tower as a text is huge and sprawling, and it's got a lot of very fervent fans. There has been a very lackluster film adaptation of it. For a lot of people, that film adaptation is what they might have heard of.
Right.
So if you're saying we're going to do a sprawling Dark Tower television series, it's going to be 20-hour-long episodes, it's going to really get into the lore, most people will be like, oh, did that have Matthew McConaughey in it?
Of course, what comes to mind for me is Dune and God bless him, David Lynch and Kyle MacLachlan, and then the sci-fi version. Right, so there's the cultural space for a given property is always going to be affected by anything that is an antecedent to it.
Yeah.
And you said something, there was a line that somebody said that you then quoted that it wasn't an adaptation. Oh, I'm trying to remember.
Yeah,
the line.
So it's John Wagner, who was the co-creator of Dredd, the character, Judge Dredd. He was involved with Dredd. He was not at all involved with the Stallone movie, apart from at one point basically collaring one of the writers at a party and being like, you better not fuck this up. I've heard how much you're getting paid. But his like reaction to everyone saying that this was a remake of the Stallone movie was that, no, this is a proper make of Dredd.
Proper make, right. That's what it
Which
was.
Which is that such a Scottish way to put it.
And you mentioned that Dredd was filmed in 3D, but we can't, as an audience, see it in 3D, let alone even get a hold of a 3D-ized version of it, even if we wanted to sort of do a Doc Brown setup in our own home basements and try to, you know... give ourselves a 3D treatment.
I did get a message from a friend after the episode went out being like, oh, I think my parents still have a 3D TV. If you can find the Blu-ray sometime. But yeah, it is this sort of extant, like largely dead technology. And the only other example that really springs to mind of you cannot watch this movie the way that you could in cinemas is kind of an expansion on 3D. It would be Spy Kids 4D, where it came with a scratch and sniff like panels, and at certain points in the movie, it would tell you, all right, now you can smell what the movie smells like. Yeah,
you
so
were cursed. You were cursed with knowledge, and now we are all.
Yeah, but Dredd, you know, it put an awful lot of eggs in the basket of shooting in 3D. And it was relatively acclaimed for doing something new with the 3D. And I'd love to have seen it in 3D, but I just didn't. And a lot of my favorite films I didn't see during the initial cinema run.
Right.
And we were talking about this with Superman and Jurassic Park. The aspect ratio of the first Jurassic Park is, it's called Academy ratio. It's 1.85 to 1, so it's quite boxy. And there is something nostalgic about that, I think, because not just because it's Jurassic Park, but also because a lot of us grew up watching 4:3 TVs, and that aspect ratio works much better on that sort of TV. And there is kind of a, you know, an understanding that we used to make stuff that was designed to live past its cinema release. And Dread might have been banking on 3D TVs being really popular as well. But essentially, they created a movie that worked really well in a technology that it is no longer exhibited or available in for the most part.
And one of the things that you often key in on in your podcasts is how the technology of filmmaking affects the creative process and then what ultimately we see as a finished product or a finished piece of work.
Yeah. And so Anthony Dodd-Mantle, who was the director of photography on Dread, he's a fascinating guy. But with Dread, he says that he was horrified by the 3D camera rigs because to shoot two cameras next to each other for 3D.
Film? Right. Not digital, but film, right?
No, digital.
Oh, they were digital. Yep. Okay. At least you didn't have two horizontally whirring spindles.
Yeah. So part of the reason that 3D kind of came back around this particular era was digital, because it was more possible to be able to do good 3D. So just like super basic, to do 3D native shooting, you need two cameras next to each other shooting essentially at the distance of human eyes. Cinema lenses are normally prohibitively large for doing that. You can't actually put two cameras next to each other at the distance of human eyes. So they will often be shooting into a mirror. They've kind of got like a perpendicular camera setup. They're big, they're bulky, and that really restricts the way that you can shoot. So Dodd-Mantle actually worked with the film rental company to develop new camera rigs so that he could shoot handheld and he could shoot really closely on Dread. But mm-hmm. that was a case of like, Dodd-Mantle, for any big nerds, was the cinematographer on Festen. Like, he is deeply embedded in avant-garde cinematography. So he was probably able to flex a bit on that, be like, come on, I'm Dodd-Mantle. I did Slumdog Millionaire. Come on, just work with me here, rather than having to work with the existing cameras. Whereas something like The Raid, they were working with what they were able to get their hands on. That is not right. A film where you're able to ring up the camera rental company and be like, can we move a lot of the camera body into a separate, like we'll outsource that, we'll cable it in, then I'll be able to do handheld. No, they're shooting with what they're able to get.
One of these days, we're going to have to do a conversation just about the technology of cameras and optics and stuff. I was just, because I was on the Fugitive with Anthony and Steve, I learned about IndoVision. It's where they're doing backlit, but then you can do another split screen thing where you can put other objects in front of an actor. So it looks like an actor is in the scene. So in the train wreck scene, it looks like Harrison Ford is running down the tracks being chased by this train, but that's actually a backlit projection thing. It's fascinating.
Yeah. And like, you know, a lot of those technologies are now effectively, well, they're not lost, but they are completely superseded by green screen. The ability of green screen, it's, you know, it's treated like the villain of modern cinema. Green screen's incredible. What you're able to do with green screen is phenomenal. Like,
it's true. Last thing before we kind of switch over to talking about Alex Garland himself as a director is I just have to shout out Lena Headey and Wood Harris in Dread.
I love Lena Headey.
Because they're just so wasted in, I mean, Dread wasn't horrible, but these are two strong,
very good
actors
who don't have much to do.
They don't have a lot of room to move. And what they give in the room that they're given is just, it was so good. She was her mama character was so, there were so many things going on. And I was like, wait a minute, wait, no, go back. And we just had to keep moving on. And she had her sort of villainous death as, you know, wah, wah.
On Wood Harris, like, it does have to be noted as well, one of the things that has aged quite poorly about Dread has got to be the cast racial makeup, in that as a movie, a lot of it is white people killing non-white people. Right. And he is kind of the highest billed and most prominent black actor in the movie. And he is Mama is the big villain. He is a much more personal and immediate villain for a lot of the film.
And the interactions with Anderson.
There's definitely stereotypical interactions between him and Anderson, who is a very blonde young woman.
Yeah. Who they purposely keep her helmet off because they spent all this money to hire this actress and they need her on her face on screen.
Well, you need her face on screen because she's the one with the character arc. She is the one who the audience are actually going to attached
follow
to.
Along with, right.
She's the one that you're going to take a photo of to the hairdresser when you're like, you know what? I think I will do the big chop and I'm going to go shorter. You know, that's a universal experience, I believe.
Right, right. Hey, everyone. David here. Wanted to tell you about a company that makes some really beautiful Middle Earth-inspired products. Actually, I wish I had discovered OSHA slings when my daughter was little and I was using a lot of different baby slings and carriers. They sent me one of their Ancients of Gondor Ithildien baby carriers. Honestly, the design of this carrier is cool as hell. The quality is impeccable. It's a really smart design and super easy to use. I wish I had this when I needed it. I would have loved to show off my dad nerd cred at the time. But they also sent me a really nice blanket, the Misty Mountains Throw. And now that same daughter, she monopolizes it whenever she's on the couch. It's beautiful, just the right weight. It's brushed cotton, so it's breathable and keeps us really cozy. We've been having a lot of cold weather lately, so we're always fighting over who gets to use it. A little about OSHA. They're a family-owned Scottish company. They've been handcrafting products since about 2010. Everything's ethically sourced and made in their solar-powered workshop. Check out their website. They've got a bunch of information about their sustainability practices. That's something that's really important to me. And they have this huge line of official Lord of the Rings products. They're making baby carriers, throws, scarves, mugs, tea towels, and the designs are stunning. Like, go check out the website right now. There's a link in the show notes. New customers get 10% off with the code LoreHounds. Go to oschaslings.com. So let's switch gears here a little bit and start talking about Alex Garland as a director. As you noted, he's a lot in cinematic news.
Yeah, he's having a very big moment at the Mo. Yeah.
Yeah, we had Civil War. We now have Warfare. We now have 28 years later. I only recently, believe this or not, I only recently saw 28 Days Later recently because one of my co-hosts, Alicia, did a whole little series on our Patreon. We have some bonus coverage of some of that material. And then we have a movie review of 28 Years Later as well. So I saw that and I didn't realize that it was Alex Garland. And I think Alex Garland really only broke into my consciousness with Civil War, which I thought
interesting.
Was a really interesting movie. And I really, it still stays with me, the movie, for lots of reasons. But I'm really fascinated. And then, of course, you threw out this comment about Warfare, which we'll talk about in a bit here. But I went and I definitely saw that. And he is having a cultural moment. And I think it's this interesting idea that as a novelist to screenwriter to director, and then like, where is he now? And like, what's going on with his
yeah.
And you've been a fan, as you said.
Yeah, I've sort of had the opposite in that way back when I was first getting interested in filmmaking, when I was in high school, I saw this film Never Let Me Go, which is this gorgeous adaptation of a Kazuo Ishiguro novel. It's directed by Mark Romanek, who also did 1 Hour Photo, and Garland wrote the adaptation of it. And so that was one of the first movies where I was really aware of like, oh, I should see who wrote this because it's so good. And then his first film, Ex Machina, came out again like a few years later. I was very aware of film by that point. I had seen Dread and I had heard that he had shadow directed it. And I'd been really interested in that, but also I wasn't as bad as I am now back then. But watching his career, Ex Machina, exceptional. Annihilation got absolutely rooted by its distribution. There is a really interesting story in that. And then Men is awful. I hated Men. And it was a really disappointing experience because by that point as well, like I'd read a couple of Garland's books. I was really invested in him as a filmmaker and I hated Men. I hated it so much. And I don't think I've hated any of his films as viscerally since, but I've definitely become disillusioned with him as a filmmaker to some degree. And so I've found that journey really interesting.
I think somebody who I'm tracking in the same way as Noah Hawley. He's written books, a number of articles, and then now we've got Alien Earth is coming out in August, and we're going to be covering that as well. I'm really excited for that. But his work on Fargo was really interesting, and I'm pretty excited for that. So
it'll be sad if Alien sucks.
It will be very sad because that's a franchise that needs the most recent film.
Romulus
gave it a little bit of life, but it still didn't quite
How did you feel about Romulus? Because I was talking to someone last night who we had opposite opinions on Romulus. Where I, for the first like 90 minutes, I was like, this is fine. It's a bit exploitative. I don't think it's doing anything. And then it got weird. And I was so much more on board when it got weird. But yeah, this mate I was talking to had the opposite thing where he was like, yeah, you could cut the last 20 minutes.
It's a little without the weird in the end of with the car in the cargo bay and that kind of stuff. It is a little bit Force Awakens where it's like, okay, let's
look at objects from the previous films.
Yeah. And retune you to the, what made you, let's give you the feels that had you fall in love. And I thought it was an interesting blend of Alien and Aliens. And of course, Aliens is my movie. As much as I love Alien, Aliens is a movie that I could just put on. I'll watch 5 minutes at any given moment of any given day and I'll be happy.
Yeah. And that is a franchise that, you know, is defined by a very different installment. Like, because Aliens is such a different key to Alien.
Yes. Yes.
But those two are, you know, the two of them make it into a series. So it's always kind of in tension with itself.
And everything else after that was, and as you say, you know, when a movie gets rooted, the third one, you know, by distribution or more by the studio, it got rooted by the studio. You know, there was a movie in there somewhere, but I think it got the treatment by the studio of giving notes and edits. But
yeah.
But anyway, Noah Hawley, I think, successfully pulled off Fargo transition from big screen. And this goes back to that whole conversation about, you know, what size screen are we watching on is less important now than it is how many parts to this thing are we watching? Are we watching 8 episodes or 13 episodes? I was thinking of The Pitt when you were talking earlier about lengths of series. And I think we're now, because I think there is an interest and a hunger, and again, we're off topic from Alex Garland, but you don't come onto a Lorehound show and not expect the conversation to wind.
Garland has done a television series in which he was a very like authorial showrunner. I think he wrote every episode on it. I don't think he directed them necessarily, but it was very much his show. Yeah.
Yeah, Dev's got good, it's not spoken of badly, as far as I know. But anyway, going back to Garland, let's bring it back around to him. I'm very curious for you to talk a little bit more about Warfare because you had a very strong reaction to it. I watched it because of what you said. I was like, oh, well, now I have to watch this. And I have an opinion on it, but it's not your opinion. And
And I think my opinion does definitely come at the tail end. So Men came out in, I want to say, 2021.
22 is the official release date.
So he's done Men, he did Civil War, and he's capped it off with Warfare, which is he has co-directed. Ray Mendoza is the co-director, and it is essentially Ray Mendoza's, not life story, it is Ray Mendoza's day story because it is one specific incident. So effectively, it is a single real-time raid isn't quite the right word, but it is an operation in Iraq.
And interesting that then that Dread and The Raid are both movies about movement.
Whereas this is very much a single location. Yeah.
Yeah. This is static. Well, you still have these assailing forces, but rather than moving up the ladder or up the building, they're fixed in a single position.
Yeah. And the single position that they're fixed in is someone's home.
Right.
And I found it to be a really callous film. I found it really out of step with kind of current discussions. And in particular, actually, I found it wildly out of step with the like audience reactions to Andor, where Andor was sort of so on the side of the revolutionary. It was so keyed into the experience of those who are subjected to Empire's power. Whereas Warfare, it doesn't, I'm sure that Garland would argue that it doesn't pass any moral judgment, but what it does is focus entirely upon the people who are committing a invasion. Like there's no better word for it. It is the invasion, not just of Iraq, but of these individuals' home, their house gets taken over and turned into a staging point.
Right, it's the war in miniature.
Yes, for this Navy SEAL operation. The home gets bombed. The family are trapped in their house as their home is turned into this staging post for a war that they are not involved in. I also found that the film lent into the idea that actually everyone on the street is an enemy combatant and they're all going to try and kill you. I just found it had a really like yucky almost attitude, and it felt very regressive. It felt very, it felt like 2002 propaganda. Like it was a very strange watch in 2025. But on top of that, it's technically a very excellent film. It's a really well-made film. It is like, it absolutely grounds you in the perspective of those characters. It's uses the, it made a point of not using score, but it does use really good sound design. Its prosthetics and kind of blood and guts are really effectively like realistic. But I cannot sanction any part of the film. Like, it's like, I'm like, it's a good film. You shouldn't have made it. Like,
And I think that's, that was my reaction was, I don't understand why you made it and why you made it now. Like, what's the purpose?
I also found, to be honest, the way that it was not necessarily marketed, but all of the discussion I had seen about it prior to release was like, oh, they made a movie with all the white boys of the month that they, you know, they made a movie that has Will Poulter and Joseph Quinn and, you know, all of these guys.
My wife walked in and she's like, oh, that's the guy from The Bear, you know.
But I hadn't realized until we were sitting down to watch it. The lead actor, and I'm going to fuck up his name, is DeFaro Watune. He's from Reservation Dogs. He's a First Nations American actor, and he's brilliant in Reservation Dogs. He's kind of just functional in this, but he does do this functional job really well. And I was thinking, I was like, I don't think I've seen another like relatively mainstream film with a First Nations actor. I've seen quite a few with First Nations actresses in lead roles, but this was one of the first times I could think of that. And that sort of got completely subsumed by the fact that the film was White Boys of the Month. Like,
I agree with you totally that technically the, and in terms of action films, it's again, choreographed well, staged well. I always understood where I was in relationship to any given thing that's going on. But what is Alex Garland's purpose as a director and writer and a primary creative doing in this movie? I don't understand why he's here in his career.
Yeah. And there's sort of, there's no sort of core premise or thesis. Like there's not, the strongest thing that you could say the film is doing is trying to do a realistic war film. And in doing so, what it does partly, you know, under that veil of realism is justify a deeply like troubled and difficult war that shouldn't have happened. But yeah, within
with
that,
no
it's
point
like,
of view of those affected by the
and
invasion.
It's a movie that kind of doesn't have a point. Like,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And
yeah, that's
I'm
where
sure,
I was. I was like, what's the point?
But I'm sure he'd argue that, you know, the that your traditional war film does have a point. So this one doesn't have a point because it's not your traditional war film. Yeah, there's just sort of, I don't want to use the word Reddit lightly, but there is kind of a oppositional attitude that Garland takes in a lot of his more recent work that, that's kind of a bit fuck you to the audience, but also it is a bit Reddit in like, oh, well, actually, that was on purpose.
Wasn't there a comment too about The Raid coming out? Was it him that said that? Was saying that, oh, The Raid hasn't is nothing like Dredd.
Yeah, he argues that The Raid has very little in common with Dredd. And that's just, I would say, not true. I can understand where he's coming from in terms of like, they, you know, they do have somewhat, there are differentiations between the two of them. But to deny the similarity is kind of ridiculous. Like it is, it's a coincidental similarity in a lot of cases, but it reminds me of, and I know we're going off topic again, there's currently a lawsuit against the movie Together, which is a upcoming horror movie starring Dave Franco and Alison Brie. It's written and directed by Michael Shanks. It has been accused of plagiarizing another film, which was a much lower budget film. And kind of the nail in the coffin on the lawsuit is that that script was sent to Alison Brie and Dave Franco's management, who passed on it. So the argument of the lawsuit is that they passed on it in order to hoard the idea and make their own film.
Right.
I'm not a lawyer. I'm not completely well-versed on this subject. I cannot imagine that this lawsuit will be successful because Michael Shanks, the writer-director, has a paper trail back well before this other film of him developing the film. He's an Australian. We often fund development of films through government agencies. Right. So there is a huge paper trail of this film existing well before this other film. But the similarities between them go down to like a pivotal third act moment involving a Blu-ray of the movie Spice World or something similar to that, like a degree of similarity that is absurd but coincidental.
Right, right.
And the Raid and Dread are like that. There are very similar beats, very similar moments. Some of them are absurdly coincidental. A lot of them are just what you would do if you were telling this story.
And there's a well-developed arbitration process among the film guilds, and because this is not an uncommon situation.
Yeah, but I think for Garland to say there's nothing in common between the films, well, I think that's a denial as well. Like, yeah.
You know, this, as you said, as you laid out at the beginning of the podcast, he's somebody that you have attached yourself to.
Well, definitely followed, yeah.
Remind me, did you say you saw 28 Years Later or not?
I've seen 28 Years, yes.
Okay, I have not. So so no spoilers for me.
Mm. Which, like, again, like, I'll give him 28 Years. It's fun. Like, there are a couple of things in it where I'm like, Alex. But for the most part, I was like, this is a good and interesting and a new spin to do on this. And some of that is Danny Boyle. Some of it is Garland. Right. Some of it is Anthony Dodd Mantle, who's back behind the camera on this.
And were you a fan of the original 28 Days?
I actually hadn't seen it until this year. And it's really interesting to watch now because the DV kind of aesthetic that it's going for, I would say it looks like shit, brackets complimentary, but it's like it's aged in a really particular way.
Right. I don't know how they got those empty streets of London. Like, that's an absolutely incredible feat in and of itself. But it feels a very auteurish movie.
Yeah, yeah. And it kind of doesn't look like anything else from the era. And it is. Right. It's quite a brave movie.
Yeah. It's got a lot of interesting angles and compositions. And yeah, the empty streets, that was a really interesting thing.
I believe this might be repeating misinformation, but I have heard at some point that part of the way they got those empty streets was they were filming at sort of 4 a.m. in summer. So you do have light in London. They also recruited the prettiest members of their production to ask people not to walk through shot. That part of the tactic was that the best looking people were just fielding the public being like, I'm so sorry, we're just shooting for like 60 seconds. Are you okay to wait here?
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, good guerrilla tactics, right? Yeah. That's, you get your film made. So where are you with Alex Garland as a auteur, not auteur creative?
I think he is kind of trying to have it both ways in the way that he reacts to auteur theory, where, you know, he will point to all of the other crew members, but at the same time, he does want that showrunner position of creatively leading a production. But yeah, I definitely I feel like once he was in a kind of higher position of regard and sort of, you know, Men is the turning point in that after Annihilation, which was, you know, really struggled with its distribution, but was critically acclaimed, and Ex Machina, which again, I will defend, it's a brilliant movie, but Men would be kind of his blank check after that. And I think Men is awful. I think that many people should have intervened on Men. And it's, you know, you could argue it's really like, it's a big swing. I would say it's a big swing and a big miss.
Is it a case where they, like you said, is it a blank check where the studio said, hey, Alex, what's next?
Go for it. I think it's his first film with A24. I could be wrong on that.
Okay, I can see him as a branded A24 director.
Very much now. Civil War and Warfare were both A24, and he's doing A24's Elden Ring. But the thing with Men is that it's not necessarily a blank check because it is very few actors. It's relatively empty locations for the most part. But yeah, I really just think that someone should have intervened on that one and
edited him out.
I think it needed to come in the script because I'd say.
Sorry, not editing in that regard. Yeah. Editing in the sense of where they always talk about this on Top Chef and things like that. You should have edited this particular dish.
Yeah. And the more I think about Men, there's some quite nasty ideas within it. And again, I'm sure Garland would argue, well, it's meant to expose that nastiness, but it's like, I don't think you needed to revel in it so much. Right. But yeah, I think he is still a really interesting writer-director. And I do agree with a lot of the stuff he does. I also disagree with a lot of the stuff that he says and does. So maybe he'll just be an ongoing contentious figure. But
what would you say is your favorite? I don't want to say favorite is a weird term, but like if you were to take all of his dozen-ish or so-ish mm-hmm. films here, what are you going to say critically that it should go on the top of the heap? If somebody says, oh, Alex Garland, I've never watched a movie, you would
definitely
say,
definitely Ex Machina. Ex Machina okay. is just a beautiful little like chamber piece. It's a really smart movie in a way. I won't say anymore, but it's just really smart. The visual effects, I think it won the Oscar for best visual effects on a relatively small budget. But yeah, the visual effects are phenomenal. It's Oscar Isaac, Donald Gleeson, Alicia Vikander, Sonoya Mizono in one location.
Good idea.
It really plays with your own audience interpretations of what is happening. And mm-hmm. yeah, it makes you part of the deception to some degree.
Interesting. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about Going Rogue okay. as a product. I don't want to say as an endeavor,
project.
As a project. Yeah, yeah. That works.
As a, you know, a curse that I've given myself.
You said something about the original Judge Dredd movie and this Dredd movie, the 2012 as well, that it sort of has everything.
Mm.
What is everything for the Tansy Gardam treatment?
Everything is probably a movie that's not good in an interesting way for a bunch of different reasons. I cut some of the things about the 95 Judge Dredd?
I think so.
Yeah, I joked before 95. That I forget everything that I've ever written as soon as the podcast goes out. But yeah, that film was also produced by Charlie Lippincott, who I've spoken about on Going Rogue a few times. He was this kind of marketing genius that George Lucas happened to be at university with, and they were good mates. When Lucas had just kind of had this enormous success of American Graffiti and he was going on to make Star Wars, he called up his mate Charlie and was like, I'm making this science fiction film. Can you market it? Charlie had just done the marketing for Jaws. So this absolute marketing genius who then marketed Star Wars, he's kind of responsible in many ways for the Star Wars holiday special. And then he went on to produce movies, one of them being Judge Dredd from 1995. So it's sort of, that is part of how it has everything.
Should it become a tradition that there's some sort of live watch event of the...
The thing with the holiday special is that it's so long. It is a long piece of media and it feels about twice as long as it is.
And especially if you watch the one that has the commercials still in it.
Yeah, as a little time capsule.
Yeah,
so that, and like the Stallone one is a case of ego. It is, and this might be conjecture, I think it is one of the movies that Schwarzenegger kind of tricked Stallone into doing. In that when one of the writers was initially like being courted to write this project, part of the selling point was that Schwarzenegger would be in it. And he was like, well, that's the biggest actor in the world. Of course I want to do that. And also at the time it was being pitched as a Tony Scott film, who did Top Gun. Ridley Scott's brother has passed away sadly now. But yeah, like brilliant director. And so all of the sort of pieces of a Going Rogue classic went into that film, where there was a huge number of scripts. There was an almost unadaptable property. There were a lot of very good directors being floated and they were not the ones who got the job. There was ego. There was a lot of money. And there was a film that ultimately is not terrible. It's not good.
Yes, definitely. So your criteria is for a Going Rogue targeted project. Has got to have these multiple layers of...
Yeah, there's got to be something worth talking about is my thing. Mm-hmm. I'm very cautious of kind of just contributing to the wind of media criticism. It's like I need to actually have something that's worth saying and worth thinking about for the audience. So Pirates of the Caribbean is a movie series that I absolutely adore. And there is a lot to unpack in there. Like, it's not just that, like, hey, they made this movie super quickly, or with the second one, hey, God didn't want them to make this movie. But, like, there needs to be something else to actually talk about within that. You don't want to be the IMDb trivia section, but out loud.
Right. So what does a typical... I don't know if there's a typical, you know, if you've got a sausage machine that you can just put all this stuff into, or... What's your methodology?
The methodology is to go into a fugue state for a few days, researching and writing the first draft, and then to actually spend much longer making sense out of that. So I'm currently in fugue state mode on our next episode. And yeah, it is that case of just kind of gathering this huge amount of information and then trying to whittle it into something that makes sense and is worth listening to.
Can you give us a hint as to, or are you keeping it close?
I'm keeping it close just because I don't know how long it'll take. But I will say that at the moment, it's looking like this will be the episode where I kind of have to contend with Harvey Weinstein's legacy of film. And
Do we need to play the foghorn sound?
Yes. But also, this is not the film that I expected to do that with.
Interesting. Okay. Okay. That's
And I'll say it's not Lord of the Rings, because the instant assumption there is Lord of the Rings. Unfortunately, right. It's not Lord of the Rings.
And you've already covered that one. So yes. That's moving on there. So as you're working on this most recent project, have you taken stock in terms of your methods and like, what is it? I think you're around 30, over 30 episodes in.
Yeah.
Have things evolved much, or are you pretty much into a structural rhythm now?
Yeah, I've done quite a lot of standalone episodes now for a while.
And you've got your Patreon too, which you're doing bonus episodes for.
Yeah. So definitely like developing kind of the standalone episodes as a structure. It means that a lot of stuff that because my first two seasons were just one film for each. And so there was a lot of depth gone into on those. And I have actually got another season on a single film that is, you know, it's coming. It is coming. But yeah, I think the standalone episodes, I'm definitely in a groove on in terms of kind of telling one story with those, whereas over a season, you can kind of get more into the minutiae of a story and kind of the different characters that go into it. And yeah.
Are you working on a series and standalones simultaneously? How many stories do you have in your head?
I've got the series that will probably be the next series is largely written. To be honest, it's overwritten. Despite being five episodes, it probably needs to be cut down by half in the script stage, because at the moment there's just too much there.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the way though, right? You start with more.
Yeah, definitely. And like even Dread, like there was quite a long section in that episode initially about the way that Alex Garland writes his scripts versus the way he directs them. Because I find that as a director, he's not reverential to his own scripts in a way that a lot of writer directors are. Like the script for Ex Machina and to a different degree Annihilation are quite different to the final cut. But Dredd doesn't have that. Dredd is very close to its script, possibly because there was another director involved. But yeah, that section was ultimately lost for time because I was like, this is maybe interesting to me, but it's not entirely relevant to the story.
Do your friends and family understand the the dragon that you're chasing with going rogue? Once I remember in our early days of podcasting was like, oh, I need to podcast tonight. I gotta get on the mic. You know, there is a degree of understanding.
No, my best mate Charlie is the story editor on the show. So he is part of the research process in that I'll be like, hey, can you come around and watch the 1995 Stallone Judge Dredd movie with me? And often he is kind of a backstop of sanity in that, like, he really didn't like Dredd. He had a very different opinion on it. He saw it for the first time a couple of months ago. So obviously a very different relationship to the movie. I saw it in 2012, a beautiful time where we thought that things would be good forever.
Sweet summer children.
But yeah, like there's definitely an understanding of it. I did have another friend recently being like, hey, we were talking about this particular thing, weren't we? And I had to be like, oh, that was on my show. We didn't actually talk about that in person. Like, I know what you're talking about, and that is my opinion. However, this isn't something we've talked about.
Outside of specific topics or projects, do you have a sense of where the Going Rogue project is going? or are you just in it right now and you just got to keep churning out the, got to be the little hamster in the wheel.
I think it ends with me knife fighting Tony Gilroy in a Macca's car park, but I assume that that's like a 10-year plan. That's not in the immediate future.
Can we get Alex Garland to film it?
Look, we did have the discussion recently of which of the directors that we covered on Rogue One would be best to fight. The obvious choice is, of course, Francis Ford Coppola, because he's an old man, so he'd be easy to fight. But I had the very bold contention. I was like, I think I could fight Chad Stahelski, who is probably the only professional fighter that we've actually covered. You know, he was a stuntman for most of his career. He's done a huge amount of jiu-jitsu. And I was like, the thing is, I think I could get the jump on him. I think that given enough time, I would be able to surprise him in a fight, which is probably the most stupid thing I've said and argued, but I stand by it.
So that's an interesting place to end our conversation.
Yeah, on. That's definitely, yeah.
In a Macca's lot, yeah.
Yeah, that's where I assume going rogue ends with either me being sued or me being like Godfather style brought into the fold. There's not a happy ending for the show, but for now it's, you know, for now we're at the midpoint.
Fair enough. So I always like to end interview conversations with this question of what three things, and I'm curious as to, outside of going rogue related topics, movies, television shows, books, music, anything, three things that are holding your attention these days.
It's not actually a recommendation. I've just finished the new Jason Momoa series, Chief of War, and I would say it's fine. It's on Apple TV. I think it comes out August 1st. That sounds like I'm advertising it, but again, it's fine. I find it more interesting as a project than necessarily as a show to watch. It's got a primarily Polynesian cast. A huge amount of it is in Hawaiian language. It's kind of an unapologetically native Hawaiian version of history. But at the same time, I'm like, this isn't a great TV show. Like, there's just something a bit uneven about it. It's also really interesting which actors really can do a lot more acting through the language versus others. And there, yeah, because Tamura Morrison plays kind of the big bad guy, and he's having such a good time, and he's really reveling in it, and he's using language so well in that role in a way that kind of draws attention to the fact that other actors are sort of struggling against the written word, which makes sense because it's a language that I think there's like 2,000 native speakers left. It's a language that has been almost eradicated. So as a show, it's really interesting to foreground that, to absolutely like sit and, you know, hold that language in history to some degree. But as an actual show, it's definitely got some flaws. And what else have I been? I'm just started reading I Have Some Questions For You, which is about a film podcaster, so I think I will be called out by it. Also Solving a Murder, which I haven't done yet. And other than that, just rewatching 30 Rock.
Okay. Is that your palate cleanser? Is that the thing that keeps
Every now and then I remember how good 30 Rock is, and I'll be like, I've got to watch some 30 Rock. And there's so much that went over my head the last time even that I watched it. Like throw away jokes about like Keith Haring and no other show has ever done it like 30 Rock.
I think my favorite little mini arc, and I'm no expert in the grandiosity of it, the span of its topics covered, but was the whole thing about writers and the importance of writers and being self-aware of being a writer herself.
I always think that like the biggest, like the smartest thing that 30 Rock did is that the show they write isn't good. Like, I think there is a version of, there is a version of it where the show they write is good and it's Saturday Night, which sort of sits so much in like, oh, this show is so important. It's comedy. This will change the scene. Whereas 30 Rock is like, sometimes you work on a show where the recurring characters are called Dr. Fart. And the fact is like, that's still a show and that still employs a lot of people and you still got to go to work every day. Like,
did you watch any of the SNL 50 coverage?
A little bit. I watched the Domingo sketches.
Are you an audiophile? Not
to a notable degree.
The SNL 50 little documentary that Questlove directed and put or was, you know, instrumental in was excellent. Just as a piece of visual, what do we call it? Film, TV? It was on television.
A documentary.
It was a documentary, and especially the opening music sequence where they take this span of music and blend visually and auditorially these songs into each other. It's the best DJ mix of this of the widest possible range of popular music. It's really phenomenal.
Yeah.
So I would even say just that little, just watching the opening of the SNL 50 music
thing. Look, I'm sure it bodes well for Questlove's Aristocats movie that he is making with Disney as a live action remake. So yeah, it's good to hear that there's real directorial talent that's going to be wasted on this project.
Well, I mean, I'm just happy that Questlove is alive and creating things, him and Lin-Manuel, you know, as long as they are able to be productive in the world, there's a glimmer of hope.
Mm.
So you're keeping your next project a little bit under wraps.
It's still relatively early stages on it. Like it's gotcha. Vomit draft stage. Just for context, it's a 20-year development hell that this particular film was stuck in, and I'm still in like 2003.
And I know we're wrapping up here, but I'm just, it pops up a question for me of what does a typical, what does a average project look like in terms of time span? So like with Dread, about how much everything from, you know, consuming all the media research, watching the movies, and then actually producing, recording and producing and the post-production, what would you ballpark a time estimate?
Dread was interesting because I actually started it prior to Ballerina, and the plan had been to release it before Ballerina. But to be honest, I just got lazy and didn't finish it in time.
Fair enough.
Yeah, it's hard.
It's your podcast. You do what you want.
Yeah, and it's hard to give a sort of direct turnaround time for anything because I'm often working on other projects around them. Like,
yeah.
I think Dread was the Easter long weekend. I had some time off and I started thinking about the movie Dread and the movie The Raid, and that's where all of that came from. But yeah, Ballerina would have started after that and turned around faster because there was actually a deadline for it.
If you were to bunch up the days and the and the writing process, is it a week?
It's definitely more than a week.
Okay.
Yeah, Fortnite? Just even like – the fact that they do take like at minimum a month pretty much is kind of indicative. Okay. And like part of that is because I'm not actually that good of an editor. Like if a professional editor saw the way I cut, I think they'd throw up. But like that's the way that I edit. Yeah.
Audio digital side or on the writing side?
On the audio digital side. Like,
okay, got it. And because you're doing all your posts yourself?
Yeah. And like quite a bit of the writing process is done through the edit. Like often the ending will be written after the initial cut.
Sure, that's not.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's interesting. Okay. I have listened to big production, you know, Serial and, you know, these kinds of things and yours, and I would put you at a high level of, I would give you good marks for your execution.
Yeah. Well, that's why it takes so long. We'll say that's why it takes so long and not because I get distracted.
Your audio ducking and your timing of everything, and you're not doing any sophisticated sound effects, but you know, you are thinking about your music cues and when to use the music to accentuate the audio that you just recorded to, you know, give it a little punch to it and that kind of stuff. So when I saw your episode pop up, we were on a driving holiday in Canada. And I said to my wife, you know, our daughter's in the back with her headphones listening to, you know, whatever she's listening to. She's into the Wings of Fire audiobooks.
Mm-hmm. Just don't let her look into any further Dragon books. Like, end it there.
Okay. Fair enough. And I said to my wife, oh, you remember the Going Rogue, stuff? And I said, she's got a new episode out. Do you mind if we listen? She says, no. And she was as drawn in to your production. She doesn't care about Stallone, Dredd. None, you know, this is not her world. And yet she was deeply fascinated by the way that you construct your stories and lay things out. So I think
That's the hope. So that's always like good to hear. Cause like, you'd know this, podcasting is a strangely one-sided medium where you put something out and it's not even like radio where there is some degree of interaction. This is out in the world. I hope you guys like it. And also it's different to, you know, YouTube, other kind of consumption mediums where there is a bit more back and forth. And like, I really like that because podcasts, like you kind of can go longer form. I've found like you can do, well, just in terms of data, you can do much longer edits much more easily. But yeah, there is an intention, which is that hopefully any episode you can listen to if you like the films or not. And it sounds like hopefully that's been achieved.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, you know, on the Lorehounds, we're very ephemeral in the sense that we're following the shows. And so our numbers, I can look on a graph and go, oh, yeah, that's when that show is out, because we get these very definite spikes when an episode drops and goes out, episode drops, you know, and it's because we're running concurrent with mostly television. But then, yeah, for something like yours, somebody can come in and drop into your catalog at any point and swim backwards or forwards. So I have no idea how your numbers would look over time, but.
Yeah, but I guess, you know, that's the thing that gives me the latitude to talk about a movie from 2012 that most people have forgotten existed. Like,
yeah, I was like, wait, is this not the, I had to really reconstruct for myself what this was. So, and you have a Patreon.
I do. Yes. Where there's,
you have a very well-priced Patreon as well.
I was going to say, if you've wondered what the show sounds like with a less intense edit, it's the Patreon, where the episodes are made far more quickly and far more, I would say, roughly. I hope it's not as notable that the audio is less considerately edited there, but...
And that's where you're putting out a lot of bonus episodes as well. So additional conversations or thoughts that you have, like, a little bit more... During Andor, you're doing some sort of quick reactions.
Yeah, although for the most part, I try to sort of, again, kind of have a point, like even talking about Jurassic World, you know, there is the argument of like, is this or is this not a Gareth Edwards film? And it's like, I think the problem is that it's a David Koepp film or David Koepp. I'm not sure how to pronounce his name. And that's the one name that I choose not to learn.
Fair enough. So are you on the internet's anywhere? I'm sorry, I just had to.
I'm keeping this in. My cat is trying to crawl onto the keyboard. She's doing a real example of scale and, you know, domination of the frame.
Right, in a little over the shoulder one-er kind of thing.
Yes.
Or whatever you call it.
No, we've got a dirty single on me.
That's it. Dirty single. That's what it is.
nothing delights people more if they're, you know, they're being interviewed for the first time than hearing that they're being shot in a dirty single.
Right. Well, your cat is very aware that you're being recorded and that you're at this is going out on the internet. My cat here was here earlier, and fortunately I have a wireless keyboard and I was able to flick the off switch on my keyboard.
Yeah.
She laid down and was demanding pets while I was talking with you.
Yeah, no, I think Tappy just needs some attention.
Because you're not paying attention to her. So she's come to.
Yes, to demand it. Yeah.
Yeah. Where can find people?
I'm on Blue Sky mostly these days because it feels slightly more ethical. I would say like the show is the best version of me. It's the one that's actually had time to think about all of the thoughts. So yeah, if you're curious, it's a good show, I hear.
Great. We'll put a link in the show notes. So thanks again for spending a little time.
No, thanks for having me.
Look forward to hearing what your next project is.
Yeah.
Your cat is giving
me she's glaring.
You one eye in the corner.
She's like doing the T-Rex from Jurassic Park, pretty much.
It's perfect.
Yes.
Thank you. You obviously is a fan of your podcast as well.
Oh, so, no, she hates it.
Great. Thanks. We'll talk to you again soon.
Catch you soon.
The Lorehounds podcast is produced and published by The Lorehounds. You can send questions and feedback and voicemails at thelorehounds.com/contact. Get early and ad-free access to all Lorehounds podcasts at patreon.com/thelorehounds. Any opinions stated are ours personally and do not reflect the opinion of or belong to any employers or other entities. Thanks for listening.